does God really want to eliminate everything secular? Is that really God's will, to eliminate everything secular?
Certainly nobody would think that our emotional responses by themselves are always reliable guides. Similarly, everybody thinks that certain kinds of emotions like sympathy can be important guides to decision-making.
Reason and Religion, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with George Marsden of Duke University, Stephen Stanley, a campus minister from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Andrews Reith of North Carolina State University. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Historians agree that religion had a lot to do with the shaping of American universities, but the place of religion on many campuses today is peripheral. As the basis for much university life shifted from evangelical Protestantism to the ideals of pluralism, the force of religion diminished in the university. George Marsden examines this change in his new book, The Secularization of the Academy, available from Oxford University Press. Stephen Stanley is campus minister at the Chapel of the Cross, which is located adjacent to UNC Chapel Hill and which celebrates its 150th anniversary this year. I asked George Marsden to reflect on the interplay between intellectual life and religion in American universities today.
If we're serious about pluralism, then religion ought to have as much intellectual rights as other groups would have. But it has to be a post-Constantinian religion. It can't be the kind of Christianity that ran everything, but it would have to be in a truly pluralistic setting where you might have a center for Christian studies, a center for Jewish studies, Islamic studies, and so forth.
Does that mean that we have abandoned absolute truth, that is to say truth with a capital T, into many truths that we are all, you know, to put it bluntly, some people will be uneasy about that equity. My truth is stronger than your truth. Stephen?
It's been said that the basis of all idolatry is the lust for absolute certainty. That we create idols of the things that we believe will make us absolutely certain of what we believe, to the degree that we don't have to ask any more questions about that. And I think a religious perspective that takes the stance of absolute certainty by definition would tend to be exclusivist in its character. And the liberal traditions, as Dr. Marsden refers to, are those that tend to stay away from absolute certainty, absolutist positions, mm-hmm. and affirm what I believe is a Christian value of humility and learning. A humility about what we don't know, as well as some certainty about what we do.
After all, we are still on this earth, and we are not yet in the next incarnation. George, tell me about the three elements that you write about in your book: technology, ideological conflict, pluralism, cultural change. These are again very complicated issues. I'd like you to give me a quick take.
Well, in brief, I think what a lot of religious people don't understand is that a lot of the reasons for so-called secularization of the universities were good reasons. That, for instance, if universities were run primarily by Christians and if they're serving the public, don't they have some obligation to serve the whole public? That mm-hmm. is, can they treat people from other religious backgrounds as second-class citizens? And so one of the reasons for dropping the religious establishment in the university was to be fair to persons of all religions. Another reason for secularization of the university would be to accommodate the needs of the technological society. That there's a great deal that's learned in the university that doesn't have a whole lot of reference to religion. And mm-hmm. so those areas might be developed not in an anti-religious way, but simply in a non-religious way. And a great deal that goes on in university would fit into that category.
Stephen, talk to me about your experience with students. Typically, we think of young people coming to the universities to be liberated. That's mm-hmm. a sort of a positive way to say it. Another way to say it is they're going to learn to think for themselves. And there is really here a sort of subversive element at work. They're not going to buy the old doctrines and the old orthodoxies. How do they come to religion on campus, if that indeed is the case?
I've heard it said that destiny is the tension between freedom and necessity. And I think one of the main issues that I see in students...
Here's a good preacher.
is what do I do with my freedom?
Yeah.
I've got it. Well, what do I do with it? Another of my favorite quotations is that hell is too many options. And I find many students who are drunk with freedom of ideas in a great marketplace in a more pluralistic environment than many have ever been exposed to before. And how do I make choices in terms of what I believe in is a central issue that I deal with every day in dealing with students. In this great marketplace of ideas, there are so many choices. How does one decide?
George, what is your responsibility when it comes to students? I mean, here you've written a book about religion on campus. Do you is this a crusade for you? Is it analytical? How do you think of it?
Well, it's something that combines being a crusade and being analytical. Maybe it's an analytical crusade. I think that in response to Stephen, I think there is probably as much dogmatism in the liberal community as there is in religious communities. And many of the radicals, secular radicals, have pointed that out, that liberalism can be very dogmatic as well. And for instance, it can be very dogmatic about the things that ought to be believed in the name of science, that science becomes the great salvation and the great revealer, and that one of the ideas that shaped the universities was that if everyone simply had the free exchange of ideas, they would all agree on a set of universal truths that would unite everyone. That hasn't happened, and I think there needs to be more modesty, really, in the secular community than there is at the moment.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that George Morrison points out in his book, I want to direct this to Stephen Stanley, he talks about building distinctly Christian institutions that will provide alternatives to secular colleges and universities. Stephen, if you did that with your students, aren't you creating more divisiveness rather than unity?
Well, I think you have to look at the premise behind trying to create a separate institution. Is it the old in loco parentis, I'm going to protect these students from those ideas? Mm-hmm. And frequently we see groups that we might characterize as sectarian or cultish even, that some of the characteristics of that overall is there's usually a charismatic leader who says to the students, we have the truth, and anyone who doesn't believe like we believe is the enemy. And what you find there is a striving for uniformity around certain propositions.
Belonging.
You can belong if you accept these propositions, and the assumption behind that truth is propositional, that we seek truth by affirming certain propositions. Now, I would question that logic, but it's a very persuasive one because there is a deep hunger for certainty. Mm-hmm. And there are groups on campus that are more interested in the cohesiveness of uniformity than they are of a sense of unity in a pluralistic environment.
Well, I think that it's a mistake to, in the name of pluralism, have a new melting pot that insists that everything in American society ought to end up the same. That is, all education ought to have one homogenized kind of point of view. Seems to me a pluralistic society would want to encourage traditions and sub-traditions. What we're saying to people now is, we love your tradition, but leave the religious soul out of it. And so we have a public education that tries to tone down any kind of religious sensibilities. I would think that it would make sense to have not only strong public education, but also religiously directed options. One of the interesting things, I think, in the history of the construction of American universities is the strong anti-Catholicism that's at the base, that Protestant universities stood for freedom, they stood for openness, and they stood for uniting all people under one democratic ideal.
So our liberalism is based on a prejudice.
Well, that's right, and liberalism is wonderful, and we should appreciate many of the benefits of it. But it's possible for liberalism to become dogmatic and then to exclude other equally responsible sorts of points of view. And I think the Catholic instance is a good one. Why shouldn't there be Catholic universities or Catholic parochial schools or the like who are intellectually responsible? And they certainly can be.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, George Morrison, Stephen Stanley. Stephen, what do you see for, look into the crystal ball, the presence of religion on our campuses? Talk to me about your own ministry at the University of North Carolina, the Episcopal Church, the Chapel of the Cross,
right,
and then generalize for me a little.
The Chapel of the Cross has been a part of the university's life, the University of North Carolina, for 150 years come this May, and the university itself, being the oldest public university in the nation.
Now, bear in mind that we're recording this in the early spring of 1992.
Yes, that's right. We've been a part of the university's life for a century and a half, and in fact, our church was founded on the premise of a ministry within the university to faculty and staff as well as students. And over the decades that this church has worked in this area, a tradition has developed in terms of being a part of the life of the university, and in a way that people with theological education and theological perspective are not coming to the university to tell them how to run their university, which they would not appreciate. But people with a theological background are most effective when they raise questions of purpose and meaning. And right now we're in an environment in higher education where there's a lot of questions about what's the purpose of higher education? What does an educated person look like? You know, and there may be lots of different perspectives on that, but not many people like Dr. Marsden are out there raising those kinds of questions, because I agree in the sense that in many instances, the original mandate for education was not just the acquisition of knowledge, but the formation of character.
Uh-huh, indeed.
And I think this is where we connect in that perspective, that the university has lost a sense of how do we engender a sense of character and a sense of community.
George, I will give you the last word here. Stephen Stanley's remarks made me think of John Henry Newman. We've come a long way from that idea of a university. Where are we now? What do you see on the horizon?
Well, to get back to your first question, that religion being on the periphery, the problem is, do universities have a center today? Is there any organizing principle other than being a coalition of somewhat related interests? I think that's the problem. That's why universities have difficulty addressing questions of character, for instance, or moral values, for instance. There isn't a center, and so we're drifting. And so I think it's, we shouldn't assume that the situation today has reached its optimal point. It could be restructured in more constructive ways.
Stephen?
I think in the university of the future, no one group will be the center, or no one race will be the center. This competition to be the center perhaps is part of the problem in our working out these issues of pluralism. But what will continue is a question about the moral use of knowledge. Not just how much do I know, but how do I use what I know? And what are the values that inform the ways in which I learn and what I do in my career? Are we turning out people who are highly educated, highly skilled, who don't really have a sense of conscience? Mm-hmm. And now this is a question of conscience, not just a question of whose doctrinal stance takes predominance, but how do we develop a sense of conscience in the people who are learning in these environments?
I want to thank you, gentlemen, for your contribution to Sounding. Stephen Stanley from the Chapel of the Cross in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. George Marston, your new book is The Secularization of the Academy, just published by Oxford University Press. Thank you for your participation here at the National Humanities Center.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Reason and Religion. Join me now for a conversation with Andrews Reith of North Carolina State University. Among the aims of philosophy is to give some general account of moral thought that differentiates between reason and emotion, but that also leaves room for both. In doing this, most philosophers make the assumption that our ordinary thinking has some discernible structure that explains the moral views we're inclined to have. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Andrews Reith is at work on a book about the 18th century German philosopher Immanuel Kant. I asked Andrews Reith to reflect on the philosophical debate over reason and emotion and to describe the ways that people make moral choices. Andrews Reith.
I think that what philosophers are concerned to do is to try to figure out how the process of reasoning that people actually use when they make moral choices. I think the assumption is that people do reason, they have reasons for their views, they think they can justify their moral views. So the question is, what is the process of reasoning that people actually use?
Would it be unphilosophical to say that we reason emotionally? Is that contrary to...
No, that's a possible philosophical view. Mm-hmm. I think many people think that, in fact, our moral beliefs are guided by emotions, and that, in fact, when we are expressing a moral belief, what leads us to our beliefs is a certain emotional reaction.
Do philosophers say, for example, that the emotional and the moral are contrary or opposing points on a spectrum?
I think you get different views about that. There are some people who say that moral thinking is basically rooted in emotion. Uh-huh. There are other people who think that morality is rooted in reason, which is in some way opposed to emotion. People in the latter camp generally think that emotions by themselves are not a reliable guide to moral choices.
Tell me about Immanuel Kant. What particular angle or take do we extract from this particular philosopher when it comes to these very difficult questions of moral choice?
Sure. Kant is one of those philosophers who thinks that moral thinking is rooted in reason, and that moral principles have to be viewed as principles of rationality in some sense. The centerpiece of his moral view is a very general principle for making moral decisions, which he calls the categorical imperative.
Oh, this is a wonderful phrase that we've all heard, and now I want you...
Many people have heard of it, so now you want to know what it means.
Exactly.
You're in luck, because I can say something about that. He states his principle in different ways. One way of stating it is the following, that I should only act from principles which I can will to hold as universal laws.
Which I can will to
hold as
universal
laws.
Fair enough.
And roughly what that means is that I should only act in ways that I could rationally will that everybody act in. If an action's going to be okay for me, I've got to be willing to let everybody else perform the same kind of action in the same situation.
Is this the Ten Commandments or the Golden Rule reduced to philosophy?
It's ideally, it might be a general principle from which one could derive the Ten Commandments. Why do we think that these are valid moral principles, if we think that they are? Uh-huh. Kant would try to use the categorical imperative to explain why we accept them.
Can we apply to Immanuel Kant a dangerous word like unique or original in the thinking that he did about moral choices, this whole business of the categorical imperative?
I think that Kant was highly original, though in a way he would have denied that. Kant did not claim to be inventing a new way of thinking. Huh. Kant's aim, in fact, in almost all of his philosophy, was to articulate and systematize the beliefs of the ordinary person. What Kant is trying to do is to spell out what reason tells us.
Did he think of himself as a philosopher? I mean, you know, we have occupations today.
Yeah.
I mean, was this man, did it say philosopher on his door and that was it?
I don't know what it said on his door, but he was a professor of philosophy.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's about at this point in time that you have philosophers who are also professional philosophers, people who make their living by lecturing on philosophy.
Uh-huh.
So certainly Kant was a university professor, and in fact, he worked very hard. He lectured for 5 hours a day.
Goodness.
And still managed to write a series of works that have shaped the course of Western philosophy since.
Let's talk about a specific application of this whole set of principles, problems that we're discussing, Andy Reith. In the newspapers lately, we see a lot of stuff about, you know, should the American people help the Russian people, mm-hmm. or the people of the former Soviet Union?
Right.
Now, is that a legitimate philosophical issue? Is that the kind of thing that one could examine in the light of your work about Immanuel Kant?
Well, I think that that Kant's moral system would have things to say about this issue. I think, this is a delicate matter because it's not always clear how ethical issues relate to matters of international affairs. But I think there are things that Kant would say. Kant, I think, could give us certain kinds of reasons for helping the Soviet Union.
What would they be?
He might cite the fact that they are agents like ourselves, people like ourselves, with needs and vulnerabilities, and that their needs and their vulnerabilities are reasons for us to help them if we can. He thinks that from his categorical imperative, he can derive a general duty to help other people. Uh-huh. Roughly, it would not be rational for me to will to live in a world in which nobody ever took the need of another person as a reason to help. And that's a kind of that's a particular moral reason for offering help when we can. It's also perfectly general. I mean, it needn't single out the people of the Soviet Union any uh-huh. more than it singles out people who live in the same city as you.
We're moving from the universal to the local, as it were.
Yeah, I think in each case, Kant would say that there are impartially grounded reasons for helping other people. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can't help everyone. So whom you give aid to, of course, is going to be determined a lot by the particulars of your situation.
How do we place the word politics into this set of circumstances? Do we become cynical? Do we become transcendent in our virtue?
We might become cynical. I think people, a lot of people are cynical about the extent to which politicians and political matters are driven by ethical thinking.
Uh-huh. Or not driven.
And I think in general, I think a politician might give a very different reason to help people of the Soviet Union. They might say that it's in our interest to have good relationships with them. It's uh-huh. in our interest to have a stable government there. Often, I think we see foreign aid as a way of shaping the policies of other countries, getting them to do the kinds of things that we want them to do.
Quid pro quo.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Or simply, we think that it's in our interest to have a stable regime in that place.
Well, now let me stop you for a moment and take us back to Immanuel Kant.
Yeah.
Do we always have an either or? That is to say, it's going to be virtue that motivates a decision like this, or it's going to be the self-interested. Did Kant, for example, talk about any kind of a middle ground between these two?
I think he did. I think Kant is notorious for being someone who thought that duty and interest can conflict. But I think there is a middle ground.
But not cancel one another out, necessarily.
No, let me put it like this. There is such a thing as permissible pursuit of one's own happiness, mm-hmm. right? When I have restricted my pursuit of my own happiness by the right principles, then I can act justifiably. I can pursue my own ends with justification. I think also the issue of moral choice is in fact an issue that people are concerned with, whether they realize it or not. We're always facing moral choices, uh-huh. and it's the kind of issue about which people do find it important to articulate their own views.
When you talk about Immanuel Kant's ideals and principles, do we put a capital T in front of a word like truth there? I mean, what separates this kind of enterprise and inquiry mm-hmm. from what we normally conventionally call religion?
Well, again, that's a complicated question, truth, morality, and religion. I think, let me talk about truth first. People distinguish science and other areas of inquiry. Scientific claims have a claim to being true in ways that other kinds of claims might not be. So one general issue is whether we can say that moral claims are true or false. Are they true and true or false in the way in which scientific beliefs are? I'm happy to say that some are more reasonable than others. Uh-huh. Regarding religion, Kant is part of a movement that is separating morality from religion, which you see beginning in the 18th century. Kant was a religious person, deeply so, in fact, but he thought that moral beliefs can be arrived at independently of any kind of religious beliefs. People prior to Kant would probably have viewed morality as something like God's commandment for humanity.
Questions of authority. Where do these answers come from?
Right. I mean, if you believe in God, then you have a simple answer for why we should be moral. Where do moral principles get their authority? They are things that we are commanded to do by someone who has power over us. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is, what do you do in an era which is increasingly secular and increasingly sectarian? If you think that morality is tied to religion, then it might follow that people who without religious beliefs have no reason to be moral. Similarly, you might think that people with different religious backgrounds will not share or cannot share a moral code. But that's probably an undesirable result. So I think that, and I think this is something that's very important about Kant and about other moral thinkers in that period, that they think that morality can be given a basis which is independent of religion or of any particular religion, and that seems to be something which is needed in a view in which religious belief is increasingly fragmented.
Here's a man who lived, what, 200-300 years ago, and yet you are describing the very problems that we face in our modern world, figuring in worlds of political diversity, cultural diversity,
right.
Facing tremendous questions of power and authority. Andy Reith, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You're a professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at North Carolina State University. You are here at the Humanities Center working on a project about Immanuel Kant. Good luck in your work.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations about reason and religion. My guests were George Marsden of Duke University, Stephen Stanley of the Chapel of the Cross in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Andrews Reith of North Carolina State University. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 619. That's program number 619, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Censorship, Propaganda, and the Press. My guests will be John MacArthur, the publisher of Harper's Magazine, and Donald Shaw, a senior fellow at the Freedom Forum Media Studies Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Reason and Religion, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. From religion in American education to the philosophical debate over reason and emotion, listen for commentators from Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University. Reason and Religion, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.